Thank you, Martin. Thank you for coming here, and thank you for inviting me here to Brno to give a presentation about a recent paper that I'm working on together with two colleagues, Julia Bretmann and Sebastian Otten from RWI in Essen. And my name is Klaus Nowotny, as I already mentioned. Now, in this paper, we're looking at linguistic distance and networks and the effect of these variables on location decisions of migrants that are coming to the European Union. Now, migrant networks, sometimes also called diasporas, are among the most robust determinants of international migration flows. So there's a quite large number of empirical papers that have shown that migrants tend to move to where migrants from the same country have moved before, okay? Because migration within a network has advantages. You can use the network to find jobs, to find houses. If you have a big network, you can even find jobs within the network, so networks are very useful if you're settling in a new country. Recently, an emerging literature has also focused on language as another important factor, either focusing on common official languages or more recently on linguistic distance. The first notable paper here was by Atsiara and Pitlikova, we're going to have our own measure of linguistic distance here that is based on work by Ibs Hording and Otten, and Sebastian is one of my co-authors also here. And the main idea why linguistic distance is important is that acquiring a foreign language is easier if this language is closer to your own language. Okay, so it's easy if you're, say, from Sweden to learn Danish or Norwegian than it is to learn Swahili, for example. Okay, and since language is very important for economic success in the host country, language differences or linguistic distances also matter for location decisions. Now, these two factors may, however, be interdependent. So the importance of a migrant network can be expected to increase with linguistic distance. If you move to a country where linguistic distance is high, then a network is immensely useful. Okay? On the other hand, the negative effect of linguistic distance can be expected to decrease with the size of the migrant network. If you're moving from China to Chinatown, you might not even have to speak a single word of English, so the linguistic distance between Chinese and English is irrelevant if you can find a job, housing, friends, and so on and so forth within your network. So we can assume that these two factors are interdependent, put it another way, that they are substitutes in the location decision. Yes?
So probably you can talk us more how you define the network, because network is defined by ethnicity.
Yeah.
So if Turkish people migrate to the places where there are more Turkish people, and now the linguistic distance is that it would not necessarily be the Turkish people, it would be other ethnic people.
Yeah.
Related by language, right?
Yeah. I was going to talk about the definition of these variables anyway in a couple of slides. Basically, we're identifying networks by country of birth. Hello. So we consider people who were born in the same country to belong to the same network. This is something that can be questioned, and we have one specification where we'll look at possible variation in these effects. And we define linguistic distance as a linguistic distance between the main languages spoken in the sending country and in the receiving region, without knowing whether the individual speaks this language. This is a problem that we cannot address with the data we have because we have no information on actual language knowledge. So we can sort of only say something about average effects for migrants from a specific country. Okay, but if you have a country that has many different languages and you have someone that's coming from or that's speaking a language that's not the main language spoken in this country, then we will have a measurement error here. And this is something that we cannot really address at the moment. There are some ideas we have here, for example, by taking, say, a weighted average of all the languages spoken in a country and take the sort of this weighted average as the linguistic distance. This is something we still plan to do but haven't done yet. Okay, but networks of people born in the same country who have been living in this in the same host country for a longer time, and linguistic distance is measured by the main language spoken in the sending country and the main language spoken in the receiving region.
So is it like 0-1?
No, it's. I'll come to this a little bit later. One paper that has not explicitly but implicitly found some preliminary support for this idea is by McDonald, who has found that non-French or non-English speaking immigrants to Canada have a higher probability of settling in an area with a larger concentration of the same ethnic group. So this is basically the same idea. Those who do not speak the official languages of Canada move to regions where there are more migrants from the same country. So what does this paper do? The goal of this paper is to analyze this interaction between migrant networks and linguistic distance in a model of regional location decisions. And we contribute to the literature not only by analyzing this question, but also by modeling the location decisions of immigrants to the European Union at the regional level, to be more precise, at the NUTS-2 level, using a large set of sending countries, and by using a linguistic distance matrix for sending country receiving region dyads at the NUTS-2 level based on the Levenstein distance, which allows us to capture within-country variation in linguistic distance. Usually, your previous papers have mostly focused on the linguistic distance between the sending and the receiving country. We're looking here at the regional level. This is especially important for countries like Belgium, where you have a French-speaking part and a Dutch-speaking part, but it's also might also be important for regions such as southern Tyrol, where the majority actually speaks German, or Åland, which belongs to Finland, but where most people speak Swedish. So we're breaking this down at the NUTS-2 level. What is our idea in a nutshell? Well, we're assuming that migrants from a specific sending country face a set of alternative regions, and that they can attach a utility to each of these regions. And we're assuming that this utility is dependent on the size of the network, on the linguistic distance, and on the interaction between these two factors, in addition to some other variables that are here summarized by X. Okay, so we're assuming that networks increase the utility of living in a region, so we expect a positive effect here. We expect a negative effect of linguistic distance, and we expect a positive interaction term. So if the size of the linguistic distance rises, then the importance of the network becomes larger, okay, because we have a positive effect here and a positive interaction term here. And if the network size increases, the negative effect of linguistic distance will become smaller. Okay, so if the network size increases, this is negative. With increasing network size, this effect is becoming larger. So since this is positive, it should become less negative. And we then assume a simple behavioral model, that is, we assume people move to the region that provides them with the highest utility. Now, if we take a structure like this, and if we assume that the error terms are well-behaved, that is, they are identically and independently distributed and have an extreme value distribution, then we can estimate this location choices or the probability that a person chooses a specific region using a conditional logit model. Okay, this is a model introduced by McFadden in the 1970s, and more recently, one does not estimate conditional logits anymore, but people usually estimate Poisson models. Why? Well, it turns out that the Poisson model and the conditional logit model have largely similar log likelihoods. And the Poisson model is much easier to estimate, it converges in a fraction of the time than it takes for the conditional logit model, so most people use Poisson nowadays. Or the so-called PPML, the Poisson Pseudo-Maximum Likelihood Estimator, which is basically a poisson with robust standard errors and some checks for consistency. So usually this model can be estimated by poisson at an aggregate level. What is the data we are using? The data we are using is a special evaluation of the 2007 EU labor force survey. The labor force survey is an annual individual level microdata, and the special evaluation we have here has the detailed information on country of birth and the region of residence at the NUTS 2 level. We were lucky a couple of years ago to get our hands on these data, because usually Eurostat does not disseminate data that has detailed information on the country of birth. We define as migrants all those people who were not born in the country they're living in. This is a problem for two countries, for Germany, because we have no information on country of birth from the German labor force survey. So we identify migrants here by nationality. And we also have neither information on the country of birth nor on nationality for Ireland, so Ireland must be dropped. The data further allow us to distinguish between migrants who migrated more than 10 years ago and those who migrated between 1998 and 2007, that is the 10-year period before the survey. And what we are trying to do is to estimate the location decisions for migrants who moved to EU14 between 1998 and 2007, who were 25 to 64 years old in 2007. So we model the location decisions only for those who migrated during the last 10 years before the survey, and we use those who migrated more than 10 years ago to define our migrant networks. And all in all, we have data that represent about 7.4 million migrants who moved to Europe in this time period from 156 sending countries. Yes?
So one potential threat is that in this data you don't distinguish people who changed their region within the country. Right? If they are asked how many years ago they arrived to the country, change the region during the 10 years, then you will not observe this.
Right? There's no way we observe this. That's one shortcoming of our data. Another shortcoming is that we do not know who are the people who have migrated back to their home countries or onwards to other countries since the time that this person has immigrated. Okay. So you may have someone who migrated in 1998 and is still living in the region in 2007. There may be people who have migrated to this country in 1998 and have migrated back in 2004. They would not be in our sample. Or there may be people who have migrated to this country in 1980 and have migrated back in 2002, that may have been important for the person who migrated in 1998, but they are no longer there. So we have no information on return migration, onward migration, or within country migration. All we know is how long have they been living in this particular country. And we don't know how long they have been living in this region, but I think it's safe to assume that for those who migrated less than 10 years ago, that most of them have not changed the region within the country. Because when you move to a country, you're usually expected to choose the region where you have a job or that gives you the best job opportunities. And then most people stay there.
Right. Yeah. And also, if you take the person who is 25 in 2007, so he might have migrated with a family.
Yeah. They might have migrated with a family. We were thinking about different thresholds. I mean, in the labor force survey, you generally don't have people that are younger than 15. And we dropped the youngest cohort because some of them may have been 5 when they migrated. So, the youngest people in our sample, they may have been 15 and may have moved with their families. But this is in 10-year in 10-year brackets. So if we switch to 35 to 64, we lose a lot of people here who are important for the labor market.
How many years they work in the company?
No, unfortunately not. No, there's a lot of things we'd love to have. Especially given a specific year of immigration, this would have been great. But yeah, we were lucky to get it on this country of birth level, and then ask no further whether we could have more than that. And I don't think they're giving this away.
These 7.4 million immigrants, is that the population? Is it like all of them, or how is the survey done? Because it's quite a huge number. Like, I don't know how many immigrants you have.
Yeah. I mean, what you have in European Union Labour Force Service usually should be a representative sample, but you have small groups that are represented, and then you have sampling weights. Okay? And what we have here is we have basically the structure of our data is we have combinations of individual characteristics, like age, gender, country of birth, where they are living, and so on and so forth. And then we have the sampling weights. We do not know how many people were interviewed for each observation. Okay, so actually what we are assuming here is that it's only one person per observation. So we're sort of overestimating our standard errors. They should be smaller if we knew the actual number. At least
7.4 million observations.
Yeah. No, this is the sum of all sampling weights of all migrants. Yeah.
Weighted.
This is weighted. Yeah. We have, well, basically because we are later bringing into a Poisson structure, then you estimate it on the aggregate level, so you're summing up all these individual sampling weights if they belong to the same sending country receiving region group.
Yeah.
Okay? And so we actually end up with about 31,000 dyads, that is combinations of sending countries and receiving regions. And some of these are zero, so there's nobody living from a specific sending country in a specific region.
Then between 200...
Yes, and 156 sending countries. Okay. Yeah. And not all of them there's a couple where there are always zero that drop out. This is like six regions or so. And, well, actually, I think it's about... between a quarter and a third that are non-zero here. So we have a lot of zeros here. Any other questions? Good. So as I said, we use the stock of migrants from the same country of birth, living in the same region in 2007, who migrated to the same country before 1998 to define our networks. Okay, so our networks are composed of those people who have moved to this country before 1998, and we're still living there in 2007. Okay, we don't know how many people have migrated in the meantime back to their home countries, or who have moved on to other countries as time has passed. We then take the stock. Add one to it and take the log. Okay? Why do we take one? Well, the log of zero is undefined, so that this variable is at least zero. And this is the same strategy that was followed by Beine and colleagues in a recent paper. Okay? We have some alternative definitions of the networks, and I'm going to show you this later on when we come to the robustness. The second main variable that we are interested in is the linguistic distance, and this is measured for each sending country receiving region dyad. And the measure that we're using here is based on the average phonetic similarity between the most commonly spoken languages in the sending country and in the receiving region. So this is a regional variable, and it is a continuous measure that is has a range between 0 and about 100. And let me just give you a short idea of how this works. Well, basically, we're focusing on the so-called 40 items Wadesh word list. Mr. Swadesh was an American linguist, and he defined these word lists, and the 40-item word list looks like this. So basically, you have words for concepts that exist in almost every language of the world. So almost every language has a word for I, for you, for one or two, for blood, night, moon, mountain, water, and things like that. Okay? So our measure takes these words and translates them into a phonetic script. Okay? So they're... A phonetic script is a script where phonemes and not individual letters are written out. Okay? And then you can compare the same words between two languages and measure how many phonemes do you have to switch to get from one language to the other language. And just to give you an idea, this is a comparison between English and German, which are quite similar. For example, if you take the English word for fish and the German word fish, they're exactly the same, so you don't have to change anything. If you take the English word breast and compare it to the German word Brust, well, there's one thing you have to change. If you compare hand and Hand, there's two things you have to change. And if you compare, say, mountain to the German word Berg, you'll have to change all seven phonemes. Okay? And we do this for all words in this word list. The differences are then averaged and normalized to account for differences in word length and account for similarities by chance. And this is done for all combinations of languages that we have in our sample. Okay? The advantage of using this approach is that it yields a continuous measure that ranges between 0 and about 100. Other approaches, for example, there's an approach based on language trees. So you take linguistic language trees and then you look at the individual branches where two languages are situated. And then you go up this tree until you find a common branch. And the idea of this approach is to give you the number of nodes you have to move upwards until you get to the common branch. Okay? This is, for example, for languages like Slovak and Czech. I think it's probably just moving up one node. If you compare, Finnish to Czech, you would have to move up many more nodes. Basically, all the way up where the Slavic languages meet the Finno-Ugrian languages. So we have a higher variation compared to these approaches, and it's computable for almost all languages. Okay, linguists disagree about these language trees anyway, so they're not carved in stone, but this comparison based on the phonetic script is quite reliable. Just to give you an idea, what are the closest and furthest pairs we have in the sample? Well, the closest pair we have in the sample is English and Jamaican Creole. This is not a surprise, as Creole languages are usually combinations of different languages, and the Jamaican Creole is heavily based on English. Finnish and Estonian are quite similar, as are Danish and Norwegian. And on the other hand, we have pairs like Catalan and Swahili, Danish and Palestinian Arabic, and Greek and Swazi. Okay, so we have quite a large variation in between languages. Yes.
So how many languages
Well, since we have 156 sending countries, so there's at least 156 here. There are a few common languages here. There are some special cases in the receiving regions like Catalan that are not the language of countries. So I'd have to ask my co-author, Sebastian, who prepared this matrix, how big is it? But I think it's something like 160 by 160 matrix.
How did you translate this words?
Well, this is done using the phonetic script.
Yeah, of course. But yeah. I mean, like, how did you do it? Like, you found some guy from the country? Or?
Well, this is based on research that was done at the Max Planck Center in Germany. They have a center for languages, and they have basically prepared all these. They have these languages and the phonetic scripts. Okay? And all we did is basically take their data and calculate a measure out of it by comparing this minimum word distance, and then it's averaged and normalized. You first need to have this information about the phonetic script, and this is of course very 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 easily done for say European countries or Indo-European countries. If you take some African countries and languages there that have phonemes that are not used in Indo-European languages, like these clicking noises. I did not say noise, these clicking phonemes. They must be represented somehow in this phonetic script so that we can compare them. Yeah. But this is built upon previous research done at the Max Planck Institute.
Thank you. In the previous paper by Ingo Sebastian, they did not construct this measure.
They used a matrix for fewer countries on the national level. So what's new here is that we have more sending countries, so we have more pairs, and we have this at the regional level. I mean, for most countries, this is not a big deal. For some countries, it's quite important.
And if somebody comes from India, mm-hmm. Where there are more mm-hmm. languages spoken?
Yeah, it's the majority language.
I take over the majority
language. Yeah. It's the same for India, for China, where you have different groups. We don't have intra-EU migration, so then I don't have to guess which one we took for Belgium. But
Belgium, to the German-speaking region, I'm compared with the linguistic distance from German to my origin language.
Right? Yeah, with Dutch.
Is there a German region in Belgium?
There's no German region in Belgium. No.
German.
No, it should be Dutch and we don't have Switzerland here among our receiving countries, but we should have Switzerland somewhere among the sending countries, and I think the language we're using for Switzerland is German because it's spoken by the majority of people in Switzerland. This is open to debate. As I said, we are thinking about taking a sort of weighted linguistic distance where you have different... languages within a sending country. We're also thinking about that, if we haven't finished this yet, whether we could have something like dialect. Okay, so the German that's spoken in Bavaria is completely different from the German that's spoken in Friesland. Okay, there's currently no way we can do this. Maybe in the future we'll have more information about dialects and we could bring this in. But we have, for example, languages like Catalan that are recognized here. Okay, what other control variables do we use that are not related to networks or linguistic distance? Well, we use the physical distance. We use colonial relationships, that's a dummy variable. That is one if the country is or was in a colonial relationship with the receiving country. And we use a dummy variable for common official language, while in other language variable we just want to rule out that the effects we are finding are driven by countries that have a common official language. And in addition, we include quite a large number of fixed effects. We have receiving region fixed effects at the NUTS 2 level to control for destination-specific pull factors, and we have sending country fixed effects to control for region-specific push factors. Okay, so everything that does not vary across decision makers is captured by a fixed effect. And here are the results of the Poisson pseudo-maximum likelihood estimation. We're gradually building a model from a very simple model that includes only networks and linguistic distance in addition to a constant. Here we see that we have, as expected, a positive effect of networks and a negative effect of linguistic distance. And this holds also if we include this interaction term, which is positive as expected. In the third specification, we add the receiving region fixed effects, and even after we include these fixed effects, we still have the same result here. And this holds also if we control for the other variables like physical distance, colonial relationship, and finally, common official language. So even if we control for those for having a common official language, we find that linguistic distance has a negative effect, but the interaction term is positive as expected. Now it is positive and it is statistically significant, but it's not particularly large. So the question is, well, is it also economically significant or is it just statistically significant? And to answer this question, we look at the change in the odds of moving to a region for a one standard deviation increase in one variable evaluated at different points in the distribution of the other variable. Okay, so if we look at the first table here, it gives us the effect of a one standard deviation increase in network size evaluated at different points for linguistic distance. For example, if linguistic distance is zero, which implies that basically the sending and the receiving country have the same language, then a one standard deviation increase in network size raises the odds of moving to this region by about 20%. If we move to, say, the median for linguistic distance, the same one standard deviation increase raises the odds by almost 50%. Okay? So this effect becomes considerably larger as linguistic distance increases. And the same holds true if we look at a one standard deviation increase in linguistic distance evaluated at different values of the network size. If the network is zero, if there's nobody living from the same country of birth in the region, then a one standard deviation increase in linguistic distance decreases the odds of moving to this region by 22%. And at the largest network size, the same one standard deviation increase decreases the odds by only 0.9%. Okay? So although the effect appears to be quite small here, it's still important once we consider different values of these two explanatory variables. Yes?
You have the fixed effects so on the size of the region and economic.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's all. That's all taking account of by these fixed effects. So the only remaining variation that we should have is variation across diets.
And network is measured relatively to the migrant population of Europe, or relative to the population.
No, this is the log of the stock. So this is not relative to another measure.
Just absolute.
This is, yeah, this absolute. The log of the stock. Yeah. Here we have some robustness checks. First of all, we included a measure for genetic distance, which is used to proxy for cultural similarities. This is based on other data that basically looks at similarities in similarities across alleles. These are groups of genes, and the larger the difference, the longer the separation of these two populations. And this is used in some papers, especially in the trade literature, as a proxy for cultural differences. We have also included this here, and it turns out to be insignificant, and it doesn't change our conclusions. In another robustness check, we have excluded those variables that have a common language, because we just wanted to check whether this is driving our results. What we can see here is that the effect of the network becomes insignificant, so this is actually zero. The effect of the linguistic distance stays significantly negative, and the interaction term also stays significantly positive. Okay? And for the range of linguistic distance that we have in our data, which is around 39,205, well, we would again have a positive effect here of the network as well. In another specification, now we have two different definitions of network size. The first is relative to all people from the same country of birth living in all regions. Okay, so the idea here is that a network size of 10%, for example, means that 10% of all migrants from the same country of birth living in all 200 regions that we are looking at are living in this specific region. This is to take into account differences in network size between small and large sending countries, and as we can see here, it has the same effect. It doesn't change any of our conclusions. Here we define the linguistic network as the number of migrants from countries where the same language is spoken as in the migrant's home country. So for example, for a migrant from Ecuador, all migrants from other Latin American countries where Spanish is also spoken are within his network. Okay. This implies, of course, that we cannot have any regions where or any combinations where linguistic distance is zero, but we still find the same results, almost the same results we had here in this column if we use these linguistic networks instead of country of birth networks. And finally, we also have an interaction here not with linguistic distance but with common official language, and we see that the effect of the interaction term is reversed, which is to be expected because common official language is one if there is a common official language. While linguistic distance is higher, the larger the linguistic distance. But even if we use sort of an interaction between common official language and network size, we still observe the same effect that networks are more important for common, where there is no common official language. Yes?
The negative coefficient of network in second column, mm-hmm. What was your explanation?
Well, I wouldn't put too much emphasis on this.
Because it's zero. Okay.
Because actually it's zero. It's not significantly different from zero. And if you take this as zero and plug in the networks, plug in the linguistic distances that we have in our data, where the minimum non-zero linguistic distance is 39, we still have a sufficiently positive effect here that is increasing again in the network size. So I wouldn't interpret too much into this because, well, it's closer to zero. Although we were still a little bit puzzled as well why we would lose significance here.
Is it saying that you don't include, for example, Australians moving to the UK?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or they're generally not included because we're not modeling intra-EU migration. But say someone from Brazil moving to Portugal would not be included.
So there is a lot of weight on these flows.
There is a lot of weight on these flows because these common official languages are very important,
But you think that the results agree according to your model? Yeah. Even if
this is zero, I mean, the interaction term is still positive. So that as network increases, this interaction term becomes larger and larger. And linguistic distance is non-negative, so this doesn't change the sign. Okay. So preliminary findings are that indeed, we hope to have shown that networks and linguistic distances are interdependent and that the interaction effect is both econometrically and economically significant. One problem, however, with the whole approach is the issue of multilateral resistance. And this Poisson model and also the conditional logic model, they require the error terms to be cross-sectionally independent. Okay? If, for example, the representative part of the utility function does not include all relevant bilateral determinants of observed flows, or if the observed factors have heterogeneous impacts across decision makers, then you have a correlation of your explanatory variables with the error term that Bertoli and Fernandez Huertas Malgraga have called multilateral resistance in an analogy to the same effect found by Anderson and Van Winkoop for trade data. In another paper, they define it as the confounding influence that the attractiveness of alternative destinations exerts on the determinants of bilateral migration. To those who are familiar with models of discrete choice modeling, this sounds a little bit like old wine in new bottles, because basically this is another way of stating that we have a violation of the independence of irrelevant alternatives assumption, which says that the relative probabilities of making two choices should not depend on the characteristics of any other alternatives. Okay? This is a very nice characterization of a well-specified model, however, hardly achieved in reality. And multilateral resistance basically goes in the same way. It says that, it's the attractiveness of alternative destinations that has an influence on bilateral migration. So what Bertoli and Fernandez Huertas Moraga did in a famous paper that was published last year is they said that, if we have receiving countries, we should put them into nests. So some countries are more similar to each other, and other countries are less similar to each other. So we should put the similar countries within a nest. Okay? And then they created interactions of the sending country with these nests. Okay? So if you have 100 sending countries and you have 5 nests, then you have 500 interactions, okay? And then you add these interactions to your model, and then you hope that effects that are common to all the countries in the nest are captured by these nesting variables. But the thing is, you don't really know. This is an empirical question, and so they started with one nest, or actually they started with no nest, and then they ran a test for cross-sectional independence on the residuals. They found that, the test rejects the null hypothesis of cross-sectional independence, so they create two nests. Then they do the same test. They find it still rejects the null hypothesis, so they continue to introduce more and more nests, and finally they stop at 6 nests, where the test does no longer reject the null hypothesis, and then they say, it's fine, now we're at the perfect model. The problem with the whole approach is that, first of all, this nesting structure is pretty arbitrary. Okay? There may be alternative nesting structures that work as well. Okay? The second one is that it requires enough variation in your data to be able to identify the effects in an increasingly saturated model. A saturated model, a fully saturated model, is basically a model where you have an intercept for each observation. Okay? And as you are adding nests, you're adding more and more interaction terms, more and more coefficients that must be estimated, which not only poses problems for model convergence, so you might not get your model to converge even after a very long time, but it takes out a lot of the variation that you have in the data until there's not really much left that you can use to identify the effects that you were actually interested in. And a final problem that I see here is there is a power problem with this test until the data confess approach. Okay, so you test the data as long as they do not conform to whatever you're trying to find, and once you've found that, you stop working. Okay, and you know that when you're testing statistical hypotheses, there are two different errors that you can make. There's a type one error, rejecting the null hypothesis, although it is true, and there's a type two error that is not rejecting the null hypothesis, although it is false. And usually statistical tests are created to have created with type one errors in mind and not with type two errors in mind. So I don't know about the CD test they're running here, but usually you say, well, if your threshold for type one error is say 5%, your threshold for a type two error should be 4 times the size of the type one error, because there's obviously a trade-off between these two. So if you say that, well, you have a power of 80%, that is the power to reject the null hypothesis if it is false, and you repeatedly test the data with the same test again and again, you may run into a problem where you not reject the null hypothesis out of pure chance, okay? And this is a problem that you have with many statistical tests, and statisticians are usually much more keen on these power problems than economists, okay? So there might be a problem that if you run the same test on different models long enough, then there is an increasing chance that by random occurrences, you fail to reject the null hypothesis, although it should be rejected. So we follow a different approach, and the idea was based on something that Bertoli and his colleague have said in the paper, and they say that the vector of parameters beta does not vary across individuals, implies that the heterogeneity in the relationship between the explanatory variables and the utility function end up in the error term. Okay, so our idea was, well, why not use a model that relaxes this independence of irrelevant alternatives assumption and tries to model the source of heterogeneity. Okay? So think about where this heterogeneity is coming from and incorporate this type of heterogeneity in your data. And the model we are using here is called mixed or random parameters logic. In a nutshell, it assumes that the coefficients that you are going to estimate from your model are not fixed, but they have a fixed component and an individual component. Okay, so the coefficient may be larger for one person than for another person. And if you do not recognize this this structure, then this individual part will end up in the error term and there create a correlation across alternatives, and which then leads to a failure which then leads to rejection of cross-sectional independence. So basically, you're assuming parameters not to be fixed, but to follow a specific distribution. And to be more precise, we're assuming that they are normally distributed. So we're estimating both a mean and a standard deviation for these coefficients. Now, which coefficients should be modeled as being normally distributed is up to the researcher. The first idea we had is that, well, since we're focusing on regions, it would be natural to assume that the source of the heterogeneity is a difference in the preferences for individual receiving countries. Okay, so you might assume that, say, all regions in the UK are sort of similar. Okay, because they are in the United Kingdom, and if you have a migrant that likes the UK a lot, or you have a migrant that hates the UK, all of these regions might have either a higher error term or a lower error term. Okay, so this creates a correlation across the regions within the United Kingdom that comes from a common effect on the country level. So what we did is we estimated the model using country fixed effects. And for these country fixed effects, we estimated both a mean and a standard deviation. So we assumed that they're normally distributed, and that this is the mean, and this is the standard deviation. In addition, we still have these regional fixed effects, but now the regional fixed effects are relative to the country fixed effect. Okay. What we find, however, is that while these country effects, almost all of them are statistically significant, but their standard deviations are not. They're neither individually nor jointly significant. So what we concluded from this model is that the source of the heterogeneity is not the variation in tastes across receiving countries. Okay? So we were looking for alternative model specifications to see where this sort of heterogeneity might come from. And the next obvious candidates are the other explanatory variables that we have in the model here. So we had another model where these effects here are all modeled as being normally distributed with a given coefficient and a given standard deviation. And what we find here is that, for example, for networks, we do find that this has a significant mean and a significant standard deviation, so that this is a parameter that is not fixed for all individuals, but it is higher for some, and it might even be negative for others. Okay? Where is this variation coming from? Well, if you think of a sending country where there has been, say, a civil war, and if you move to another country and the network there consists of an ethnic group which you do not belong to, you might not want to move there. Okay? Just to give you a simple example, if you're from Rwanda and you're moving to a region where, and say you're from the ethnic group of the Hutu, and you're moving to you want to move to a region where the ethnic group of Tutsi is very strongly represented, you might not want to move there, although you're from the same country of birth. Okay, so the network effects may be negative for some individuals because there's differences in ethnic groups within a country. An alternative interpretation why this effect has such a large standard deviation is that if you're a highly skilled migrant and the whole group is characterized by low-skilled migrants, you might want to avoid statistical discrimination. Okay? If you're a university graduate from Turkey, you might not want to move to specific German regions if you want to avoid statistical discrimination because you believe that German employers will believe that you have not the right amount of skills. We find that linguistic distance does not have a significant standard deviation, but a significant coefficient here, a significant mean here, and we find a significant mean and standard deviation for this interaction term here. Now, one of the reasons why we may not find a significant standard deviation here is because we're also looking at common official language that might absorb some of the heterogeneity that would be observed in linguistic distances. For example, if, as we already discussed before, if you're from a country that has a lot of different languages, you may not be a representative of the largest group that speaks the majority language, but you may speak a completely different language. So the linguistic distance that we're measuring here might not apply to you, but we find that this is not that this does not appear in the model. And one explanation is that maybe this is captured in part by this common official language dummy. But we still find that we have a positive and significant interaction term here. Now the problem with this approach is that if you assume that these coefficients are normally distributed, it doesn't really make sense to assume that they're independent. Okay, you would assume that there's some kind of correlation between the coefficient of the interaction term and the coefficient of the network variable. So we estimated yet another model which models these two variables as being normally distributed and having as normally distributed and being correlated. So there's no interaction term in this model. Instead, we estimate the elements of the variance covariance matrix for these two coefficients. And what it tells us is, first of all, we have the variances here. This is the variance of the network variable. If you take the square root, we get about the same size of the effect we had here. And this is the variance of the linguistic distance variable. Same applies here. And we also find a significant covariance between these two coefficients. Now, this leads to a slightly different interpretation than the interpretation we had in mind at the beginning. Because the idea we had in mind was that the effect depends on the levels of the other explanatory variable. But if the coefficients themselves are correlated, then the effect depends not on the level, but on the effect of the other variable. So this is a slightly different interpretation than the one we had in mind initially, but it still shows that, if the effect of the network is high, so if a person if networks play a large role in the utility function for one person, then linguistic distance will play a smaller role, okay, because this has a negative effect in the interaction term. The covariance is positive, so this becomes less negative. And on the other hand, if someone has, if for someone linguistic distance is very important, then the effect of the network should also be small. Okay, this is a little bit of a different interpretation than the one we had initially. And that's basically the last model I wanted to show you today. So I thank you again for your attention, and I'm looking forward to some more comments and questions. Thank you.